Hello and welcome to everyone that's listening in to today's Webber Training Teleclass. My name is Jane Barnett and it gives me great pleasure to introduce the first broadcast from the South Pacific Webber Training Teleclass series for 2009. This year we've got a fascinating program lined up with experts from both Australia and New Zealand, so thanks very much for joining us today. Without further ado, I'd like to welcome our speaker today, Julianne Toop. Julianne's a clinical nurse specialist in infection prevention and control here in Canterbury Health Board in Christchurch. She's been working in this specialty for 12 years and during this time has worked nationally within New Zealand as a member of the National Division of Infection Control Nurses and as part of the Pandemic Technical Advisory Group for the Ministry of Health. She's also worked for the Ministry as part of a group that developed national guidelines on multi-drug resistant organisms and more recently has been seconded to develop an interactive education package for them. Julianne's passionate about preventing healthcare-acquired infection and has developed a great deal of expertise in relation to outbreak control, so we certainly don't mention norovirus around Julianne, if at all possible. She's also a great advocate of the Webber Teleclass program, and I'm very pleased to say that she's recently joined the planning group for the South Pacific series as well. So welcome, Julianne. Thank you very much for agreeing to be the first Teleclass speaker for the South Pacific series for 2009. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Jane. We'll just go to my first slide, which is a picture of Fitzhugh Margaret Hospital. This is an assessment, treatment and rehabilitation hospital with a large part that's devoted to older persons' health specialist services for over 65-year-olds. Also on site are specialist mental health services. The Princess Margaret Hospital, or DPMH as it is commonly known, is part of the Canterbury District Health Board, which has six main hospitals, one of which is the major acute tertiary hospital. Next slide. Just for those of you who are not in New Zealand, this is a little map of New Zealand. It is slightly larger in area than Great Britain. We have a population of 4.29 million, whereas Great Britain has a population of 60 million people. New Zealand is divided into two main islands, and Canterbury District Health Board is the major provider of health services for approximately 465,000 residents throughout the Central South Island, and you can see it near the middle of the slide in front of you. And DPMH is situated in the city of Christchurch, which has a population of nearly 369,000 people. Next slide. On Friday the 13th of October 2006, a 94-year-old woman began to deteriorate rapidly with overwhelming sepsis in one of the wards. This was her 15th day in the Princess Margaret Hospital. It was immediately recognised that she was dying in similar circumstances to two other patients who had died in the previous 13 days of overwhelming sepsis with rapid wound breakdown. Group A streptococcus had been identified in their blood cultures. Next slide. During this presentation, I will describe this outbreak of invasive group A streptococcus. I will discuss a model called the Swiss cheese model of system accidents and use this when outlining each of the case histories. I will also outline a root cause analysis process that was undertaken to identify possible errors in patient safety, and I will hypothesise on the spread of infection as well as review the management of this outbreak. Next slide. So let us first look at group A streptococcus or streptococcus pyrogenes. It is a gram-positive cocci which appears in pairs or chains from the beta hemolytic group. It's a common human pathogen colonising between 15 to 20% of the population. It is transmitted mainly through droplet spread and also direct contact from hands. There is some fomite spread, but this is rare. Next slide. This is a picture of what happens when group A strep is cultured on a blood agar plate. It appears in white to grey colonies, 1 to 2 millimetres in diameter, and it's surrounded here by zones of complete beta hemolysis. Next slide. Group A strep infections manifest themselves in several ways. First of all, asymptomatic carriage, which I've just mentioned, and superficial infections, which are estimated that there are 10 million mild throat and skin infections every year worldwide. Other infections include strep throat, impetigo, cellulitis, erysipelas, and scarlet fever. Next slide. Here are some gruesome-looking pictures of four infections caused by Group A strep. In the top left is the Group A strep throat, which probably several of you have had in the past. This shows intense erythema of the tonsils and the creamy white exudate. On the right top is a picture of impetigo, or commonly known here as school sores, with scabs or crusts and serous ooze. On your bottom left is cellulitis caused by Group A strep, and on your bottom right is a person with erysipelas, with the telltale fiery red colour and the sharp demarcated areas or edges. Next slide. More severe manifestations of Group A strep include the following: post-streptococcal immunological sequelae such as acute rheumatic fever and acute glomerulonephritis. And finally, severe invasive disease, or IGAS, invasive Group A strep. Next slide. Severe invasive Group A strep is defined as isolation of this bacteria from normally sterile body sites. It has a high mortality. It's divided into three groups. The first is streptococcal toxic shock syndrome, which is shock and multi-organ failure early on in the course of the infection. The second is necrotizing fasciitis, which is characterized by rapidly spreading necrosis of subcutaneous tissues and fascia. Others are ones that meet the definition but are neither toxic shock or necrotizing, and these include bacteremia, peripheral sepsis, or pneumonia. Next slide. Early signs and symptoms of necrotizing fasciitis include fever and severe pain, as well as the normal signs of infection at a defined point of entry, such as swelling, pain, and redness. In the top slide, you can see a hematoma has appeared, and in the bottom slide, it demonstrates the severe surgical intervention required to halt necrotizing fasciitis. Next slide. I just want to talk for a moment about Group A strep virulence factors, of which there are a number. Group A strep has over 120 M protein serotypes. M protein, major cell wall components, of which the most virulent are M types, EMM1 and 3. Group A strep is able to evade phagocytosis, induce tissue destruction, trigger host cytokine release, produce streptolysins, as well as pyrogenic exotoxins or superantigens. Next slide. EMM typing, or phage typing, defines the major antigen on the surface of Group A strep and serves to characterise and differentiate different strains. An increase of invasive Group A strep was identified in New Zealand at the main referencing laboratory, where a total of Group A strep isolates in 2004, 7.6 of these were EMM1. 2005, the rate was much the same. However, in 2006, it had more than doubled, having risen to 18.4%. And this is just to tell you that the outbreak strain at Princess Margaret Hospital was in fact EMM1, and it was, of course, 2006 in the year that we've had such a rapid increase. Next slide. Before I go on to discuss the case histories, I just wanted to describe the Swiss cheese model, which is a model of how accidents can occur. This system approach concentrates on the conditions under which individuals work and tries to build defences to avert error or mitigate their effects. So you have to imagine that each slice of the Swiss cheese is a defensive layer. And those defensive layers can be a number of things. They may be engineered, like alarms, or they might be having different people who do different jobs, or another layer could be procedures, policies, administrative controls. And their function in a healthcare is to protect the potential victims from hazards, those victims being patients, staff, or visitors. In an ideal world, each defensive layer would be completely intact, but however, in reality, they're more like these slices of Swiss cheese with lots of holes. But unlike a cheese, these holes are continually opening and shutting and shifting their location. Next slide. The presence of holes in any one slice doesn't normally cause a bad outcome, but what can happen is that the holes in many layers momentarily line up, as is shown in the slide, to permit a trajectory of accident opportunity, bringing a hazard into damaging contact with a victim or a patient error, as shown in the slide. Next slide. This outbreak was considered a major sentinel event reportable to the Ministry of Health in New Zealand. root cause analysis was used to develop this report. Its aim was to identify those holes in the Swiss cheese to see if these could be plugged and improve patient safety in the future. Next slide. This timeline we developed to indicate the outbreak period that the management team worked for from on Friday the 13th. And I will outline the case histories of each of these three patients. In these following slides, occasionally a little slice of Swiss cheese will appear, and that is to identify a possible hole or an error in the system that occurred. Next slide. This slide shows the ward layout that these patients were in. If you have colour, you'll see there's a little yellow room up there, room 6. This was where an 89-year-old woman was admitted. It was a 4-bedded female room. This lady had been a previous ward inpatient and was discharged to a rest care facility. She wasn't coping there and was readmitted to the ward, to this room 6, after a fall 3 weeks later. And she is most likely our index case. Next slide. What was startlingly obvious in her clinical records was the identification of 5 ulcers that had not been present at the previous admission. Clinical notes described these ulcers as low to moderate exudate and used various words as slough, necrotic and fragile. However, the clinical notes revealed that no wound swabs were taken and no Braden risk wound assessment tool was completed. It was partially completed, not totally completed. No medical review of the wounds was done, despite requests in the notes for this review. And a decision was made without any rationale as to dress them every 2 days, therefore limiting further access to the wounds. Next slide. During this lady's final 48 to 79 hours, her clinical notes indicated that she seemed to be improving. Her dressings were changed. She was mobile during the day, but unable to be up and about in the evening before her death. She had to be prescribed morphine for painful legs, but according to the note, she slept well. And at 0800 the following morning, she was unrousable. Her temp was 38.3. She had a pulse of 120. Her blood pressure was 140 on 80, and her oxygen saturation had dropped to 74%. A hematoma was noted on her left leg. It was from mid-calf to the back of the knee. And when nursing and medical staff wanted to review this hematoma and rolled her onto her side, it ruptured. Also, a new sacral pressure area was noted as she was being turned over. Next slide. She was transferred to a single room. There were no contact precautions put in place. She became peripherally shut down with marked metabolic acidosis and disseminating intravascular coagulation. She died at 5:30, and her subsequent blood cultures revealed that she had group A strep. Next slide. On the evening that this index case slept well, a 97-year-old man was admitted into room 2. This is shown as the blue room opposite on your slide. This was a 4-bedded male room. This man had complex comorbidities. He had dementia, poorly controlled diabetes mellitus, hyperthyroidism, hypertension, had recurrent falls, had poor vision and hearing. And so go to the next slide, please. A little bit about his history. He'd had a fractured left hip and a hemiarthroplasty. He was discharged 6 days later after this from the main hospital to a long-term care facility. However, 3 days after his discharge, he arrived back in the ED with increasing confusion. He was febrile. He had a raised white cell count and neutrophils. He had low blood sugar levels, creeps in the right base. And it is important to note here that he had skin tears on his left and right arm and elbow, which were cleaned and steri-stripped in ED. Next slide. This man was admitted or transferred from ED into the Princess Margaret Hospital, where on admission overnight he tried repeatedly to get out of bed, was pulling at the dressings and bandages on his arms. He had another fall where he opened the existing skin tear and this was redressed. By the next morning, his condition had improved. He was more coherent. He was afebrile. His blood sugar levels were satisfactory. His chest X-ray, he had a chest X-ray revealing pulmonary edema and possible chest infection. Some wounds oozing was noted from these skin tears, but there were very limited details in the clinical notes. And on day 2 and 3, no observations were done, and there was a question as to whether this was due to the pain in his arms or to his irritable state. Also, his irritability may have increased due to increasing pain in his arms. Next slide. On day 4 of his admission, at 10:30, he looked unwell. This is what the note said. His temp was 37.5 and sepsis was expected. He was looked at again at 11:20. A hematoma was noted on his left arm, which had not been present 50 minutes beforehand. His arms were too painful for blood pressure to be taken. He was moved into a single room. No contact precautions. He, of course, deteriorated rapidly with peripheral shutdown and metabolic acidosis and died at 8:20 in the evening. His subsequent blood cultures also grew group A strep. Next slide. So there's the timeline regarding the first two patients, and it has to be said here that infection control didn't know about either of these patients until 2 days after the death of patient two. And when in the ward to follow up patient two, infection control was alerted to the death of patient one, and then of course went on to alert senior medical staff. There had been another two patients elsewhere in the hospital with group A strep, and an investigation was set up to see if there was some correlation between these. Next slide. Now this is the Friday the 13th patient, and again you've got a picture there of the ward layout, and you can see that she was admitted into room 1, and if you've got colour you'll see that is the pink room, and this was a 4-bedded female room. Next slide. Now, this lady was 94 years old, and despite this advanced age, she was considered to be an excellent candidate for rehabilitation following a fractured neck of femur and a fractured distal radius. She was independent with all activities of daily living. She was up and about, she walked with a frame, and she was extremely cognitively competent. Next slide. But by day 15 of her admission into PMH at the ward round, she was found to be febrile, and I've written that on the slide there, 37.8. She had a blood pressure of 80 on 60, pulse 110, oxygen saturation was 70%. She was confused. Her right leg skin integrity had begun to break down with a copious dishwater discharge. She was moved to a single room but not put in contact precautions, and she died at 5:30 that day. Next slide. Throughout her admission, she did have marked pitting edema to both lower legs, but some changes had occurred that may have indicated what was occurring to her during the previous 3 days. On day 12, a leg lesion had been noted in her notes. On day 13, the patient had a slight temperature of 37.3, and it was noted that the skin on her right leg had begun to break down with increasing serous leg ooze, and she'd actually requested morphine for pain, but otherwise she appeared well. And on day 14, it was noted that she had a hematoma on her right leg. Next slide. Here again you can see the layout of the ward, but this is also to tell you that 9 days after the death of the third patient, or what I've called here is Friday the 13th patient, a previous inpatient was readmitted with group A strep pneumonia. She had been discharged from this ward the day before patient three had died, but was in the adjacent bed to her in the same room. This patient had chronic obstructive pulmonary disease with bronchiectasis, frequent coughing, and was colonised with Pseudomonas aeruginosa. She survived with intense antibiotic treatment. And if you go to the next slide, although it's slightly a repeat, this is kind of to combine all the information for you, the timeline at the top indicating the four patients and the ward layout below indicating where these patients were. Now, just a little bit more about this ward or wards in assessment, treatment and rehabilitation areas of this hospital. All these patients shared the same nursing, allied and medical staff. There were shared toilet facilities, the bathroom facilities, and of course they shared the lounge and dining room facilities. And we're just going to move on now to talk about the outbreak meeting, which was called on Friday the 13th. So if we just move to the next slide so I can discuss the management. Comprehensive management plan was developed with the main priority of preventing further cases, and I've divided this into three sections. The first section was looking at screening and chemoprophylaxis. As I mentioned before, there was a review of two other patients in the hospital with infections caused by group A strep, but they were not in the same ward. And at this first outbreak meeting, it was discovered that the phage type was different between these two patients and the index case in the outbreak ward. And the latter, of course, was identified as the highly virulent EMM1 strain. So all the management was now concentrated on this one ward only. Next slide. It was decided to take pharyngeal swabs of all staff in clinical hands-on care in the outbreak area, all patients obviously in that outbreak area, and relatives of any positive patients. Wound swabs were taken of all inpatients in this area, and all staff wounds in the outbreak area that were present during the outbreak and not healed. Next slide. Penicillin was prescribed for all exposed staff who were in hands-on clinical care in the outbreak ward, and that include all the on-call and casual staff that had been in that area and all patients in the outbreak area. And for those allergic to penicillin, they were offered an alternative. It was stressed to all staff of the importance of completing the course of antibiotics. However, it was revealed later that some nursing staff had decided not to complete the course as it made them feel unwell, and they were concerned about the effect of antibiotics on their body system. I personally found this surprising, particularly after such a severe invasive disease in three patients with 100% mortality. Next slide. Much of the rationale for this phase of the management plan was based on several papers that were accessed from the intranet at extremely short notice when we called an outbreak meeting. I've just identified this particular paper because it was valuable as it compared outbreaks in two long-term care facilities in Ontario. The first long-term care facility had three outbreaks of invasive group A strep. And in the first two of these outbreaks, they screened the possible contacts of the positive cases and only treated the positive cases. Then they went on to have a third outbreak, and in the third outbreak they changed their approach and all staff and residents were screened and treated with repeat screening 1 month later and no further cases or outbreaks. Next slide. The paper went on to compare another outbreak in a different long-term care facility in Ontario where they followed the guidelines of the third outbreak in the first facility, and they screened everybody, did a mass antibiotic treatment and repeated the screening 1 month later and again had no further cases or outbreaks. And so based on this, the team decided to follow a similar management plan, and other papers referenced at the end of this presentation supported this decision. Next slide. The second section of the management plan was what infection control was required. Infection control precautions were based on possible transmission, with the knowledge, of course, that group A strep outbreaks are very difficult to control. So they were going to focus on contact with hands, particularly, and equipment, but remembering, of course, that fomite transmission is possible but unlikely, and also precautions based on droplet spread. Next slide. However, before any specific infection control precautions were put in place, the ward went into outbreak mode with a norovirus outbreak. So staff were in both contact and droplet precautions to try and prevent the spread of norovirus. Obviously, hand hygiene was greatly increased, and cleaning was enhanced with the use of dilute chlorine solution. And at the end of the norovirus outbreak, of course, a terminal clean of the entire ward occurred. But all of these activities were due to controlling and preventing the spread of norovirus, and it is really difficult to analyse what impact this had on stopping further cross-infection of Group A strep. And in some ways, it was the one time that I could be positive about having a norovirus outbreak, because really we were doing so much to prevent that, that really any cross-infection from Group A strep couldn't occur. However, the one thing that I particularly looked at was the wound care, and reviewed what was happening in the ward, and encouraged all staff to remember a strict aseptic technique and that they should be wearing gloves and aprons for all wound care, because in some cases they were not always wearing gloves and aprons. Masks were introduced immediately for wound care, and this was basically to prevent any further pharyngeal colonisation of staff from the patients or wound infection from the staff to the patients. And remembering that, of course, that there were no results from screening, so some of our staff may have been colonised in the throat, and that any antibiotics they were on would take at least 48 hours to be effective. Normally we clean down our dressing trolleys with detergent and water, and we introduce disinfection of these trolleys prior to any wound care. We checked out to see if there was any shared tape, and actually there was very little shared tape, but any that there was removed. And an alert went out hospital-wide that any wounds were to be treated as suspicious and medical advice to be sought if it was rapidly progressing cellulitis, especially with any skin blistering and or necrosis. Next slide. The third section of the management plan was to do with communication, and this was really a very big part of the management plan and involved a lot of work on that Friday the 13th, because all relatives and ward staff, every ward staff member was informed during that evening, and all general practitioners and long-term care facilities were contacted over the next few days, as well as local laboratories that were not involved in the hospital. And the staff of the Canterbury District Health Board were also informed. And information was supplied to the media. Next slide. Despite meticulous attention to wording and using of correct terminology of necrotizing fasciitis, this was our first headline, Fish Eating Bug Kills 3. Media attention was extremely focused on the hospital and very hard on all the staff and the patients there. Next slide. So now I'm just going to talk a little bit about some of the screening outcomes. 112 screens were taken, or swabs were taken. 76 of these were staff, and of those 76 swabs, 45% were nursing staff. Of those nursing staff swabs, 4 or 12% were positive. There were no other positive swabs either in any of the relatives, any other patient, and any other staff member that had been screened. Of the nursing staff, 3 had pharyngeal carriage and 1 had an infection in her foot. She had been at her general practitioner for another reason, and the GP had noticed a wound on her foot and didn't like the look of it, swabbed it and put her on penicillin straight away. She had negative pharyngeal carriage, but of course she was on penicillin at the time of the swab. Next slide. Regarding the staff positive results, for these, the staff that were positive, we repeated the screening at 72 hours after the antibiotics had been completed, and then again 1 month after the completion of the antibiotics. Screening was offered for their families, but most of these staff had already sent their families to the GP. And treatment, of course, was offered for anybody that was positive. Next slide. In this slide, I've gone back to the Ontario paper that I discussed previously, and this was just to compare and demonstrate the high infection and colonisation rates at Princess Margaret Hospital. In the long-term care facilities, both of them in Ontario, the residents ranged between 2.8% and 4.7% of infection and colonisation, whereas at PMH we had 8.7% of the total patients exposed during the outbreak period, so it was literally twice the number. And again, the long-term care facilities in Ontario showed that between 1.3% and 1.5% of staff were infected or colonised, whereas Princess Margaret had 12% of nursing staff, or if you looked at that as the total staff exposed and screened, it was 3.5%. And whichever way you look at that, it was a high infection colonisation rate. Next slide. So, how did the infection spread in this outbreak ward? It is really difficult to be accurate, as no wound swab was taken of the index case on admission. But it is believed that patient one was admitted with group A strep in her wounds. Staff member one did the wounds of patient one. This staff member wore open-toed shoes, but there was no obvious wound present at the time, and it is wondered whether she dropped something or scratched her foot at some stage during the wound dressing. She was interviewed and could not recall any incident that had occurred. Patient two, we do believe, had direct transmission by the hands of the staff, probably directly into the skin tears on his arms and elbows, or perhaps the patient himself had group A strep on his hands as he was constantly pulling at bandages and dressings. This most likely occurred on the day that patient one died, remembering that, of course, when they moved this patient to look at her leg, a hematoma burst, she had copious discharge of her wounds, and there was no contact precautions. And the staff would have been very busy in dealing, of course, with patient two, who had some confusion. When it comes to staff 2, 3 and 4, which were colonised in the throat, all of these staff care for at least one patient, but there is no obvious correlation between the staff and the patients. Patient 3 and 4 are the ones that shared a room. Patient 4, if you remember, had chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and was frequently coughing. And it's possible that this patient had become colonised in the throat and coughed over patient 3, or more likely that patient 3 had been infected from colonised staff actually in her wounds on her legs. Next slide. Much of the root cause analysis findings that have been described through the case, I've described through the case histories, but during the interviews to establish other root causes, staff queried the wound care practices. These were then reviewed, and in particular the evidence for wearing of personal protective equipment, and what I mean by that is gloves and aprons. They also queried whether they should be wearing masks all the time, and whether they should be treating wounds in the open wards. So all of these things were looked at. The other thing that was looked at or noted was that there was limited clinical practice and knowledge, particularly regarding wounds. Staff were unsure when to swab them. Sorry, go to the next slide. Staff were unsure when to swab, and a flowchart was introduced as shown in the slide. You probably won't be able to read this, but it just gives staff some direction as when to swab patients. Also noted at the Princess Margaret Hospital is that there was no expert wound specialist on site, although advice was available over the phone. A new position has been created, but this is yet to be filled. It was also noted that wound policy did not specifically cover treatment for specific patient groups such as the elderly, and this is yet to be addressed. There was also amongst the staff a lack of recognition for the need for isolating high exudating uncontainable wounds, and education has occurred generally. We now have a very strong wound care group and who've done an awful lot of work regarding education. Next slide. The looking at the root causes or the central event findings, we also the environment was also looked at. This was a 20, and you see again on the slide here, picture of the ward itself. It is a 25-bed ward which has very limited isolation facilities. There are only two single rooms and two two-bedded rooms, whereas the rest were four-bedded with below standard bed space between each of the patients. And on top of this, it was a very cluttered environment with a lot of rehabilitation equipment, both in the corridors and in the bedrooms. This has since been addressed. We've now gone from four patients per room to three patients per room, and equipment storage has been available now outside the ward for equipment not in use. Next slide. The central event also, or the root cause analysis, also found that there were some communication issues. And it was noted that the process for reporting, disseminating and tracking of microbiological results wasn't clear. And also the expectation of responsibility for laboratory staff and alerting clinical staff to issues and trends wasn't always consistent. And these issues have since been addressed. Next slide. We're pleased to find that we had no further patients that developed group A strep. All root causes were investigated and reviewed, and changes were made as required to ensure that this type of risk of outbreak was minimised. The follow-up improvement program has continued over the last 2 years. I've outlined in these slides quite detailed information so that you can see how we approach this outbreak to prevent further spread. Next slide. My thanks, of course, has to go to Dr. Alan Piffey, who's one of our infectious disease physicians, for his support during the outbreak and the following sentinel event investigation, and also to the staff of the Princess Margaret Hospital, who worked extremely professionally through difficult times. And if we go to my slide, these are some of the references that were used in the development of the management plan and for this presentation. And that's my last slide.
Thanks very much, Julianne. I have to admit, I never thought I'd hear you say that you were glad to have a norovirus outbreak. It obviously helped you with the whole cleaning and outbreak control for this. So I have to say it's really good to have a sort of clinical case study session to kickstart the teleclass series for us, because it's really good to get that insight into the measures that you put in play.
You know, when you send off your swab to the labs and they come back with a group A strep and you think, oh, yes, that's good, do they take the micro work out further to identify the virulent varieties of bugs? That's going to cause a lot of damage very quickly. And us in the general hospitals will be going, oh, my goodness, should we be looking further or just stick with what information we've been given?
I think with any presence of group A strep and with any bacteria present in a wound, that you have to then look at the wound. You'll probably have signs of infection with that, and so you need to look at whether or not that you've got high exudate, etc. So you need to be considering whether or not that person needs to be in isolation or not, and whether it would be contact isolation that you would be looking at. And then you'd be looking for changes in that wound, such as the ones that I described. I mean, this was a rapidly, and as you can realise that some of these wounds, one of those patients didn't even particularly have wounds, but it was a rapidly deteriorating wound with this high serous ooze that required isolation. Was that the full? I think you also asked about whether the laboratory would be looking further, and I guess that they send most of these isolates off to the referencing laboratory.
Yeah, and the time delay between those results, we wouldn't know.
When you take your swab result? Or
yeah, when you get the swab result and it comes back as group A strep and the laboratory takes it out further, when do they feed back to you? What's the time delay?
The referencing laboratory can be a number of weeks, so that really, and that's what we found. We were having had that delay that we recognised that our first index case, because of the delay of a couple of weeks before the outbreak management plan, we were able to identify that it was a different phage type. But then having looked at those other patients with group A strep, they had ongoing wound infection, but it wasn't necrotizing in any way at all. So you'd be looking for symptoms of that. And again, I guess it's down to your clinical assessment.
Yeah, I was about to say it's down to your clinical picture, wouldn't it? Yeah. Okay, thank
you.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay, thanks for that question. Are there any further questions for Julianne? Okay, if people do feel that they would like to perhaps ask Julianne for particular advice around this fascinating topic of group A strep, then please don't hesitate to drop me an email. My email address is on your handout and on the slides, and I'll certainly make sure that I pass that on to Julianne. In closing, thank you very much, Julianne. I think you've given us a fantastic insight into control measures put in place for a very important organism here that's clearly had devastating effects, and it was clearly a very stressful time, I think, all around. So thank you very much for giving us that insight and overview, and of course for being our first South Pacific telecast speaker for 2009. For those of you listening in, please don't forget that you can access any of the Weber teleclasses by registering via the website and either listening to them live or via the rebroadcast or recording. I do hope that you'll be able to join us for what promises to be a varied program in 2009. But until then, from all of us here in Christchurch, New Zealand, thanks very much for listening in, and goodbye for now.